Shalom, welcome to ASJTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Chasdai, Pesach Ben Dov, Meir Ben Yecheskel, and Yosef Ben Meir. Let's get right into our questions from our great JTFers this week, and we're going to start off with the great wandering Samurai 81, who writes, and I quote, "Is Armenia an anti-Semitic country?" unquote. Well, there are sometimes manifestations of anti-Semitism in Armenia. It shouldn't be an anti-Semitic country for one very simple reason. The Jews and the Armenians have the same enemies. The Turkish Muslim Nazis murdered 2 million Armenian men, women, and children 100 years ago. And so the Armenians are surrounded by Muslim Nazi enemies that want to destroy them, just as the Jews are surrounded by Muslim Nazi enemies that want to destroy them. So it's really ridiculous, it's really absurd for people who should be natural allies to be in a situation where there's hostility toward the Jews. There shouldn't be any, because Israel and Armenia should be natural allies because of our common enemies. But of course, we know from history, it doesn't always work out that way. Thank you, Wandering Samurai. And now we go to our great friend Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, what do you think of the Woody Allen situation? What a creepy guy, thanks," unquote. I agree with you completely that he's a creepy guy. That, in fact, that's quite an understatement. This is a self-hating Jew of the worst type, who perpetrates the worst type of anti-Semitic Jewish stereotypes, who deliberately plays on those stereotypes and makes the Jews a laughing stock. And then he gets married and he adopts children, and the children he adopts he winds up sexually assaulting. He sexually attacks the children that he has adopted. He's just a sick, evil, disgusting, self-hating piece of garbage. A complete disgusting disgrace. And so many Jews in this twisted, insane generation of ours think he's so wonderful and he's so funny and they like him so much. He's very popular among many Jews, even though he represents the worst type of Chilul Hashem, the worst type of desecration of God's name. Even in his movies, even the character that he portrays in his movies, where he makes the Jews look like such pathetic, ugly, wimpy zeros. And he's so proud to do that to the Jewish people. I mean, just disgusting beyond words. And it shows what a sick generation we live in. The Jewish people have so much to be proud of. What a great nation. What an amazing history. God chose the Jews to be a light unto the nations and a holy nation, a nation of priests. And instead, they want to be like Woody Allen. Really pathetic. Or at least, not more than just a few would rather be like Woody Allen. Thank you, Joe Gutfeld. And we now go to the great Lewinsky Stinks, Dr. Brennan Rocks, who writes, and I quote, "Is Black Judaism, quote unquote, or Black Islam worse?" unquote. I think Black so-called Judaism, the Black Hebrews and the Blacks that claim to be Jews and distort Judaism, I think that's always worse. Because Judaism represents the Bible and represents the Word of God. Whereas we know that Islam is a false, lying doctrine. So if they want to join Islam and they want to further falsify a doctrine that already is fundamentally a lie, I don't think that's as bad as going into the religion of the Jewish people, which comes out of the Bible, which comes out of the Torah, which God gave the Jewish people at Mount Sinai, and distort that, I think that that's much worse. Lewinsky Stinks now writes, and I quote, "What was the outcome of the obese Negro who crushed the park benches lawsuit?" unquote. You know something? I don't know what happened in that situation. I actually don't know what the end result was. And now Lewinsky Stinks writes, and I quote, "Discuss Marcus Garvey," unquote. Okay, very important. I'm glad that we're bringing this up on the program. It's a figure that I don't think we've discussed in the past. Marcus Garvey was an anti-white racist and an anti-Semite, so of course There are streets named after him in Harlem, and blacks adore him because he hated whites and he hated Jews. When he committed fraud against his own followers, stealing from his own followers, and he was tried and convicted, he blamed the Jews for all of his legal problems. The Jews were the ones that did this to him, he claimed. He also met with and supported the Ku Klux Klan. I know that sounds strange, a black guy meeting with and supporting the Ku Klux Klan, but Louis Farrakhan also met with and has expressed support for the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, these sick, demonic, hateful people, they all gravitate to each other sometimes, from different races, from different groups. All these sick, demonic people, they tend to stick together sometimes. They tend to be attracted to each other's ideology. He supported the KKK. Marcus Garvey repeatedly supported the KKK, supported Hitler and Mussolini during World War II. Or actually, before World War II. And Marcus Garvey promoted the Back to Africa movement for blacks. Now that's the one good thing that he suggested, in my opinion. He suggested that blacks should go back to Africa. That's their roots. That's where they should go. That's where they belong. Now, that would be great, except for the fact that he never went, nor did any of his followers. You know, it was all talk. We're going to go back to Africa. Yeah, that's where Africa. That is where civilization began. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Meanwhile, all of them would rather sit around and collect, of course, money from Whitey in the United States than go back to these primitive jungle countries in the third world. But if they would go back, I think it would be a wonderful idea. That particular idea of Marcus Garvey, I agreed with. And so this was basically, in summation, a sick, evil, hateful, racist, anti-Semitic piece of garbage who is now honored and even lionized in the black community. But what else is new? This is what's done with all the racists and anti-Semites in the black community. Thank you, Lewinsky Stinks. And we go now to our great friend Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, "What do you think of President Buchanan, pre-Civil War 15th president, not the Nazi, President Cleveland and Andrew Jackson, were they good?" Unquote. Binyamin, I've been giving you this answer for several weeks, and I don't like having to give you this answer because I want to answer all of your questions, and I feel badly when I can't answer your question. I feel badly about it because I feel like you're asking a question and I'm telling you I don't know enough, and you know, I don't want to disappoint people, but Binyamin, I don't know enough about these presidents and about the history to be able to judge whether they're good or they're bad. I know something about them. I know something about Grover Cleveland and something about Andrew Jackson, what Andrew Jackson did. Andrew Jackson was a populist, and I know something about them. But I don't know enough to know whether their actions were actually in the long term good or bad actions. I don't know enough about them. I don't know enough about the history. I don't know enough about the circumstances surrounding what they did. I'm not a 19th century historian. 19th century meaning what happened in the 1800s. I don't know enough about American history in the 1800s. Of course, I know there was a Civil War, and I know there was Reconstruction, and I know before the Civil War there was slavery, and I know the basic facts that most people know. But, and I know some details about the Democrats and the Republicans and the Whigs and so on and so forth. But I don't feel I know enough to make definitive judgments about whether someone was actually a good leader or not. I just don't think I know enough. I'm sorry, Binyamin, for that, but I don't want to give an answer based on ignorance. Thank you, Binyamin. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, the voice of reason, common sense, and logic, who writes, and I quote, "One, talk about SodaStream," unquote. Okay. SodaStream, by the way, for those who don't know, is one of the companies that's being boycotted by the anti-Israel and anti-Semitic boycotters, even though it's run by the worst self-hating Jewish anti-Semites. SodaStream employs about 1,300 people. The vast majority of their employees are Arab Nazis. The vast majority of people they employ, they go out of their way to employ Arabs. Now, what happens when you give money and a salary to Arab employees? What happens is that keeps them in Israel. You're giving them and their families an incentive to stay in Israel, plus to bring other Arabs from the rest of the Arab world to come in and see, oh, look, they're living good. We want to come in. Look how well they're living. We want to come in and to Israel as well. So it keeps them in Israel and encourages others to stay in Israel and even others to come to Israel. And also enables them to support large families and supports the local Arab economy. Every penny that's given to the Arab Nazi enemy is a disaster for the Jews. We should be starving them. We should be making their economy as bad as possible so they'll want to leave. Instead of making them as uncomfortable as possible in order to encourage them to leave. We're doing everything possible to keep them there and make them as comfortable as possible so that the Jews will wind up leaving, God forbid. That's what SodaStream is. And by the way, SodaStream's owners, as the great Shlomo, our great admin Shlomo, pointed out in his post, SodaStream's owners are left-wing, self-hating Jews who openly support Israeli national suicide. They support the creation of a so-called Palestinian state, retreat to the pre-1967 suicide borders. They say that if a Palestine state is created, they'll be happy to operate their business in a so-called Palestine state. Of course, there is no Palestine, there are no Palestinians. That I think all of our great JTFers know, although we always have some new people coming on, so it's always worthwhile for me to repeat that. The claim that there's a Palestine or a Palestinian people is a complete fallacy with no historic validity whatsoever. In any event, these people that created this company, SodaStream, they say, if all of this land is given up to a so-called Palestine state, we'll be happy to operate our business in the so-called Palestine state and strengthen the Palestine state and have the Arabs take over all of this Jewish land. We'd be happy to do that. In fact, they support that and they want that to happen. They say, we want that to happen. They also have a mosque and make sure to, you know, on their premises to make sure that the Muslims that are there can pray to Allah for the destruction of the Jewish people, of course, because that's what they pray for. I mean, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. Do you know that they pay their employees there 10 times as much? They pay their Arab employees 10 times as much as these Arabs would earn if they didn't get a job with SodaStream. First of all, most of the Arabs who are employed by them would be unemployed if not for SodaStream. And those that do get jobs would only be earning 1/10 of what they're earning with SodaStream. And you realize how much damage this does to the Jewish people, to help the enemies of the Jewish people like this? So this is a company that should be boycotted and they should go out of business. Jews should be the ones, pro-Israel Jews should be the ones leading the boycott against traitors like this. And now Dr. Dan writes, and I quote, "Boycott on Israel, a blessing in disguise," unquote. Well, Dr. Dan, that depends. That depends. The boycott, the anti-Israel boycott, can be a blessing in disguise. It could also be a curse. It depends on how the Jews react to it. If the Jews say, "Am levadad yishkon uvagoyim lo yitchashav," which means, this is a people that shall dwell alone and not be reckoned among the nations, which is what it says in the Torah. If the Jews realize that their isolation and the fact that Jew haters don't want to have anything to do with them, that this is a blessing. If they realize that, then the boycott would be a tremendous blessing for Israel. It would lead Israel to become more independent economically, socially, politically, militarily, demographically. It would be a tremendous blessing if the Jews enabled or used the blessing to wake themselves up and to understand what's really going on in the world. On the other hand, if the boycott convinces the Jews, oh, this is terrible, oh, we're going to be all alone, what are we going to do? We can't go on like this, we can't be isolated, it's very bad, let's give up everything, let's surrender everything. If that's going to be the reaction to the boycott, then of course the boycott would be a disaster. So it depends upon how the Jews react to it. Depends upon Jewish reaction. Right now, the Jews are reacting in the wrong way to the boycott. They're so worried, they're panicking, they don't know what to do. They're so anxious to trade with all of the Jew haters that want to destroy them. who then, of course, place conditions. You want to trade with us? Okay. You've got to give up Judea and Samaria and expel all the Jews and give up Jerusalem, your capital, and go back to suicidal borders. The Jew haters make these demands because they want Israel to self-destruct. So it depends upon how the Jews react. If we were a mass movement, then we were reaching the people of Israel with our message on a regular basis. Many Jews, if not most in Israel, would realize, in my opinion, would wake up and realize that when Israel is isolated by Jew haters, when the Jew haters isolate us, and I'm speaking about Jew haters here, I'm not speaking about righteous Gentiles, we want to have contact with righteous Gentiles. But when Jew haters want to boycott us and don't want to do business with us, that's good. That's good. We shouldn't be doing business with them to begin with. We should be independent of them and have no and in no way be vulnerable to their pressure. The only way the Jews will ever understand that is if we become a mass movement and can explain this to them and prove it to them with programs on a regular basis. So we're trying our best to reach as many people as we can with the message. Let's hope that we can reach as many, or that something wakes the Jewish people up before it's too late, God forbid. And now Dr. Dan writes, too, talk about O'Reilly Obama interview, unquote. Well, Bill O'Reilly from Fox News interviewed Barack Hussein Obama. Yimach shmo v'zichro, may his name and memory be obliterated. And, you know, there were many aspects of the interview that were interesting. Obama, of course, never told one word. There was not one word of truth that came out of his mouth. Everything he said was a lie. One of the more interesting aspects of the interview was the IRS scandal. Obama insisted that the IRS is not targeting conservative groups and pro-Israel groups and all these other groups. No, it has nothing to do with that. They just made a little mistake here. They weren't deliberately targeting groups that are against Obama. Not much. No. The left-wing, white, self-hating scum that Obama puts in these positions in his administration, and the blacks, the black racists and Jew haters that he has in his administration, they would never be unfair to pro-Israel groups or to Tea Party groups or to conservatives. Never. They would never even think of so. How could any? I mean, you don't any of you haven't any of you ever dealt with black bureaucrats in government to know how fair they are, how impartial they are, how wonderful they are? No, they would never do this deliberately. It just so happens that hundreds of conservative and Tea Party and pro-Israel groups were hit with all types of harassment, and their applications for tax-exempt status were never approved, and they were hit with all types of harassments. And the minute somebody started opposing Obama or criticizing Obama, they were hit with all types of letters from the IRS and audits. No, that's all coincidence. That was all coincidence. Amazingly, Obama's allies never had any of these problems. These problems only occur for people on the right. But of course, that's all a coincidence. That was not deliberate. There was nothing deliberate there. Now, if Republicans had ever done this to the left, or had ever done this to Democrats, can you imagine? This would be a scandal 100 times as big as Watergate. But because Obama and the Democrats did it, the news media covers up for them. And Obama just lied his head off. I mean, just plain out lied and ignored all the facts in the O'Reilly interview. And now Dr. Dan writes, and I quote, three, any Democrats ever pleasantly surprise you, unquote? Not for many years. In the 1970s, the last Democrat that pleasantly surprised me was Senator Scoop Jackson of Washington State. Senator Scoop Jackson in the 1970s was actually a very good friend of Israel and a very courageous leader. He pleasantly surprised me. He was the last Democrat to surprise me pleasantly. All the others since then, for well over 30 years, have been bad, in my view. It's a party that is committed to the left and committed to evil and committed to socialism in the United States and to anti-Israel policies in the Middle East. All of their presidents, look at all of their presidents, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, Barack Hussein Obama, how they relentlessly pressure Israel to commit suicide. I mean, these are, the Democrat Party is the enemy, is certainly the enemy of the Jewish people, even though most Jews are Democrats, because most Jews are the enemies of their own people, because they're nuts. But the fact is, the Democrat Party and what they want to do to Israel, they are the enemies of the Jewish people. They're also the enemies of America. Everything they want to do in America will destroy this country and is destroying this country. Thank you, Dr. Dan. And now we go to the great Smash Islam, who writes, and I quote, "One, was Tom Clancy patriot or fraud?" Unquote. Oh, he was a fraud. Oh, he was a complete fraud. I mean, this is a guy, first of all, this is a guy who writes these war stories, glorious war stories. He never served in any war. He was never in the military. He got out of it. So, you know, personally, I don't know. I think someone who only writes these glorious war stories and writes about how important it is to be heroic and fight in the war and everything else, and he himself never did, I think that in and of itself, I do think that that's an issue. I think that that does say something about him as an individual. In addition to that, of course, his anti-Semitism. You know, the way he portrayed Israeli Jews and the chutzpah, the goal of him to tell Israel that Israel has to give up her capital, Jerusalem, and go under international control. You know, which is something that he wrote about, that Israel should go under international control, should be forcibly taken from Jerusalem, should be forcibly taken from the Jewish people. I mean, what a nerve this guy has. What a chutzpah. So, I think he's a fraud. And he's not with us anymore, but I think he was a fraud. Smash Islam now writes, and I quote, "Two, please give yamach shmo to cop-hating black Muslim Nazi rapper Ice Cube, who is now a big Hollywood star," unquote. Absolutely, yamach shmo v'zichro. May his name and memory be obliterated. Isn't it amazing? All the Jews in Hollywood sucking up to another black Muslim racist and Jew hater. How amazing it is. All the black Muslim Jew haters and racists are always the most popular people among the self-hating Jews in Hollywood and the self-hating whites. I have to tell you, I take when Jews behave like this, it really gets on my nerves even more. You know, maybe because I'm Jewish, but I can't stand these self-hating Jews. And the Hollywood self-hating Jews, they are so atrocious. Ice Cube, by the way, just in case people think Smash Islam is exaggerating, he's not at all. Ice Cube openly calls himself a Muslim. And not only does he openly call himself a Muslim, he openly supports Louis Farrakhan. He supports Louis Farrakhan. He supports the so-called Nation of Islam. And of course, his so-called rap is filled with the lowest, most degenerate filth, because he's filth. He's filth. The culture and community he comes from is filth, and the Hollywood scum that support him are filth. Thank you, Smash Islam. And now we go to our great friend Chicago Jew, who writes, and I quote, "A Jewish acquaintance of mine mentioned Leviticus 19:34 in the Torah as to why Israel should allow Arab Muslims to stay in Israel," unquote. Well, that's what happens when you read one verse and don't know what it means and take it out of context, Chicago Jew. Leviticus 19:34 refers to Gentiles who convert to Judaism. When it says you have to be good to the stranger because you were strangers in the land of... I think that's the verse he's referring to. I'm almost sure that would be the verse that he's referring to. Be good to the stranger because you were strangers in the... Remember, you were strangers in the land of Egypt. It's referring to Gentiles who converted to Judaism. It's not referring to Arab Muslim Nazis in Israel who want to destroy us. That same Torah commands the Jews and warns the Jews that they are either to expel or destroy all of their enemies, the seven nations of Canaan, the seven Canaanite nations. Expel or destroy them. And they were given a choice of expulsion or destruction. That's what the Jews were commanded to do. That's what the Bible clearly commands, and when the Jews didn't behave like that, they were punished. So, you know, If you're going to read the Torah, you have to read the Torah correctly. And you also have to know what things mean by reading it with the Talmud. Without the Talmud, the Torah is a closed book. You know, people, I guess some of this involves Hebrew. In Hebrew, we have something called nekudot. Nekudot are vowels. It means points, but it's actually the vowels that are written under words so that we know how to pronounce the word. Because you can pronounce Hebrew words, if Hebrew words don't have vowels, you can pronounce Hebrew words several different ways. You cannot even read the Torah the way it's written. You cannot read it in the original Hebrew unless you have the Talmud to tell you how, which words you're reading and how to pronounce it, because there are no vowels in the Torah. The original Hebrew, the Torah as written in the original Hebrew, is without vowels. You don't even know how to read the Torah in the original Hebrew if you don't have the Talmud. You can't do it. The Talmud tells us what each word is and how to read each word with the vowels. The Talmud is what tells us that. The Talmud is the rabbinic commentary in the Midrash. The Midrash is the oral law. Without the Midrash and without the Talmud, we cannot read the Torah. We would not know what it says. People who say, oh, I'm not interested in those rabbis and the Talmud. Okay. Then forget about the Bible. Because everything you're reading in the Bible comes from those rabbis and the Talmud telling you what those words are in the original Hebrew. You wouldn't know what those words are in the original Hebrew without those rabbis in the Talmud putting vowels on them. Now, I know that someone who doesn't speak Hebrew wouldn't understand this as much. But anyone who knows anything about Hebrew knows that these are facts. And so, first of all, you have to read the Talmud, and you have to understand what the oral law says, and the law clearly is referring to Gentiles who converted to Judaism. That's number one. And number two, to understand that the law in regard to enemies of the Jewish people in the land of Israel is very clear. Yes, if there is, and even if there's a Gentile that doesn't convert to Judaism, if he's not an enemy, if he is not our enemy, if he accepts Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel, of course we're supposed to be kind and we're supposed to live peaceably with an individual like that. If he accepts the seven laws of Noach, and of course we're supposed to. But if someone's an enemy, you absolutely are not allowed to coexist with an enemy. Absolutely not. Not allowed to tolerate that. Absolutely not. You couldn't have a clearer message in the Torah. So, anyway, just some information for you, Chicago Jew, to know why we take the positions we take. The positions we take are authentic Torah Judaism. Thank you, Chicago Jew. And we now go to the great Da Vinci, who writes, and I quote, "Isn't it strange that the Arabs celebrated the death of Ariel Sharon? After all, he handed over Gaza to the Islamic Ummah," unquote. Yeah, I agree with you, and that's because most of the Arabs are stupid. I mean, they're stupid. To them, any Jew is their enemy. And the fact is, Sharon was the best thing that ever happened to them. Now, you may say, and you know, some of the supporters of Sharon say, well, he built those Jewish settlements, he helped build them so he can destroy them. If he decides he wants to destroy them, he can destroy them, because after all, he helped to build them. And he did sometimes play a role in helping to build some of the Jewish settlements, which he later destroyed. You know what that's like saying? That's like saying, parents raise a child, they raise a baby, they raise a child, and then they decide they're going to kill the child. And they say, well, after all, we gave birth to the child. And we brought him up, and we were nice to him. And we fed him and clothed him and brought him up. So if we want to kill him and we want to get rid of him, we have a right to do that. Because we're the ones that gave birth to him and brought him into the world and fed and clothed him. So why can't we murder him also if we want to? That's the same type of mentality. Sharon was a catastrophe for the Jewish people, and he was the best thing that could happen to the Arabs. The fact that the Arabs celebrate his death just shows that, thankfully, God has been merciful to us and he's given us enemies that sometimes are even dumber than we are. That's a miracle, by the way. Many times the Arabs are even dumber than the Jews. And I know you're going to think, well, the Jews, they're a brilliant people. The Jews are a brilliant people when it comes to science, when it comes to medicine, when it comes to literature, when it comes to art, when it comes to culture, when it comes to technology and inventions. The Jews are the most ingenious people in the world when it comes to those things. But when it comes to their own survival, they are so stupid, you can't even begin to describe how crazy and stupid they are. And God miraculously, one of the great miracles is that God miraculously gives us an enemy, the Arabs, who most of the time are even dumber than we are. That's a tremendous miracle. And this is an example. Thank you, Da Vinci. And now we go to the great spiraling leopard, the great Robert, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, what is the place of the Zohar in Judaism? Thank you, Robert, unquote. Okay, great question. We really have, first of all, the word Torah just basically means instruction. It's a form of instruction. And so we have three Torot, we have three books, three examples of instruction in Judaism. We have Torah she-bichtav, which means the written Torah. That's the first five books of the Bible. First five books of the Bible are what we call the written Torah, Torah she-bichtav in Hebrew. That represents the past. Why does it represent the past? The minute you write something down, it's the past. Everything you do right now, during this second, you can never repeat exactly the same exact way in the future. What happened this second will never be repeated again in the future. Things are constantly changing in this world. This is a world of constant change. And the minute you've written something down, the minute you've committed something to writing, it becomes part of the past. That doesn't mean it's irrelevant by any means. The past is very relevant. The past is vitally important. So the written Torah is essential that we read the written Torah and that we understand the written Torah, because the past can be a guide to the future. But it is the past. It's a story. It's telling us there's some history there, but it's history that's, it's not a history book, because it's history that's intended to teach us moral lessons and to be a guide for our behavior. That's the written Torah. That's one Torah. The second Torah is what we call the oral Torah. Torah she-be'al peh, we say in Hebrew, which is the oral Torah. The oral Torah is the Midrashim, the Mishnah, the Talmud. That's the oral Torah. That's the Torah that is not part of the Bible, but that was also given to the Jewish people and given to Moses at Mount Sinai. Now, the oral Torah represents the present, because the oral Torah is constantly, there's constantly being interpretation and understanding, and rabbis are making decisions, and Jews have to make decisions. It's about how to follow the commandments and what to do and what's the latest. And it has to remain current and has to be part of the present, because you have new things that come up all the time. You can't just have a religion that stays frozen in the past. For instance, in biblical times, we didn't have electricity. We didn't have computers. We didn't have electricity. We didn't have a million things we didn't have. We have to know what is the Torah law in regard to all of these things. And so we have to be able to make rulings. And so the oral Torah is a Torah that is dynamic, that is constantly coming up with new rulings and rabbinic interpretations and rabbinic understanding based upon the foundations, of course, of Judaism. So that's the written, that's the oral Torah. That represents the present. The written Torah represents the past. The oral Torah represents the present. And then we have the Zohar. The Zohar represents, Zohar, by the way, literally means like a bright light. The Zohar represents the future. It's an understanding of prophecy, and it's an understanding of where we're going, of what the prophecies mean and of where we're going. It's very, very complicated and very, very deep stuff, very deep symbolic stuff, very hard to understand. The most brilliant rabbis have a very hard time understanding it. It's very, very deep symbolic stuff with many different layers of knowledge and wisdom. But it's understanding what our future destiny is and what the prophecies really mean and where we're going in terms of the final redemption. So the Zohar represents the Torah of the future. That's, in a very general way, an understanding of the Zohar. Thank you very much, Robert. And now we go to our friend, Australian Christian, who writes, and I quote, "What is your opinion of Joseph McCarthy? Were innocent people unfairly targeted by McCarthy?" Unquote. Well, I think Joseph McCarthy had a great opportunity to expose communists in the government and communists in the media and communists at all levels of American society. I think he had a great opportunity because those communists really were there. There are communists and there are traitors in Hollywood, in the government, in the State Department. All the other things that he said, they're all true. Those places are filled with communists. That was all true. Unfortunately, he didn't handle it well because he was an alcoholic. And he had serious drinking problems and serious mental problems. And so he broke down. He couldn't take all the pressure. He didn't handle himself well when you had the McCarthy hearings, the McCarthy versus Army hearings and the Senate hearings. He didn't handle it well at all. And so he gave a bad name to anti-communism, which is a terrible thing because anti-communism and being against treason is a good thing. So I think there were a lot of negative aspects to what he did. I don't think that he handled it well. However, what he said by and large was true about the communists and the government and communists at all levels of American society. Were there occasionally innocent people unfairly targeted by him? There might have been a few cases, but the vast majority of people that he pointed a finger at were, in fact, guilty. Most of the people that he was against were, in fact, guilty. Because there really are a lot of traitors in government and in Hollywood and elsewhere. This is a reality. So it's a shame that you had a flawed messenger delivering a true message. But that's what you had with Joe McCarthy. It's a shame we didn't have a more skillful and a stronger messenger delivering that message, because it was an important message. Thank you, Australian Christian. And now we go to the great Imaknik, who writes, and I quote, "What was your opinion on the John Stewart versus Ken Ham debate on evolution versus creation?" Unquote. Imaknik, I was very, very busy this week. I was not able to see that debate. I could not see that debate. But to me, as I've said before on this program, I do not consider that particular debate, at least for me, it's not particularly relevant. Why? Because even if there was evolution, and I think it's possible that there was, even if there was evolution, that means that that God didn't create evolution? Who started this process? Who did evolution? Who did all of these things? That means there's no God? That's ridiculous. It's absurd. The fact that there's a God, to me, is not even a question. I don't know how there could be a debate about that. The fact that you have a creation proves that there was a creator. The fact that the world exists proves that there was a creator. So, and by the way, the fact, you know, people say, well, is God really a good God, a God of love? Of course he is. He created us. He doesn't need us. The fact that he created us proves that he loves us. The very fact that he created us. Obviously, he had a good intention in creating us. So, you know, the evolution versus creation, I think that's a phony issue. Whether there was evolution or there wasn't evolution, I don't even care about that. It doesn't matter. Because if there was evolution or there wasn't evolution, there was still a God. There's still a God that created everything. That there's no question about. Anyway, thank you, Imaknik. And now we go to our great friend, Kahana Loyalist, who writes, and I quote, "Der Chaim, could we hear a Rabbi Kahana Zatzal story?" Okay, let me think for a minute. Okay. In 1983, I got off of federal probation. I was on probation more than once in my life, but one of the times was in 1983. I was on federal probation. And my federal probation ended in 1983. And once I got off of probation, I was able to rejoin the Jewish Defense League, the JDL. And Rabbi Kahana very much wanted me to rejoin and to take over the JDL and to rebuild the JDL because the JDL had fallen apart. Why did Rabbi Kahana want the JDL rebuilt? Rabbi Kahana, 1983 was the year before he was elected to the Knesset. Rabbi Kahana was concentrating his efforts mostly on Israel at that point. But he knew that his absence in the United States and the fact that he wasn't running JDL, he knew how horribly damaging this was to our brothers and sisters in the Soviet Union. He knew that we needed a JDL to fight for Soviet Jewry because in the early 80s, and in fact throughout most of the 80s, Soviet Jews were not being allowed to get out. They were not being released. In the 70s, some of them were allowed out because of the earlier JDL actions. Tens of thousands were released. But then in the 80s, the Soviets closed the door again because JDL fell apart. There was no more pressure from JDL. And so in the 80s, Soviet Jews were not getting out. And the Soviet Union was falling apart, and still they weren't allowing the Soviet Jews to leave, and they made it clear that if the Soviet Union falls apart, they're still, you know, you're going to have the same bureaucrats in charge of whatever comes after the Soviet Union, Russia, Ukraine, and all these other countries. And those same bureaucrats are going to say, no, you can't leave. They're going to create bureaucratic obstacles to the Jews leaving, and they're going to say, and then they'll deny, if somebody says, hey, why aren't you letting them leave? They'll deny that they're not allowing them to leave. They'll say, what are you talking about? They don't want to leave. That's not true. What are you talking about? And if the world is silent and lets the Soviets or the Russians or whoever came after this comes after the Soviets, if the world allows them to get away with it, then the Jews don't get out. It's as simple as that. So Rabbi Kahana knew the only hope we have for freeing our brothers and sisters in the Soviet Union is a renewed JDL. And not only that, we need a JDL that is willing to do the really bold things that have to be done, which means bombings. Bombing Soviet diplomatic targets to make sure that the issue is publicized and make sure that Soviet-American relations are endangered from this issue, that this really threatens Soviet-American relations. He knew that there was a need for this. And he knew in 1983 that, you know, who's willing to go out and do bombings and do all these things? He knew Chaim ben Pesach will do that. So he wanted me to take over JDL. He wanted me to do that, and he called me up. He heard that my probation ended. He called me up. He was in the United States, visiting in the United States. He lived in Israel, but he was visiting in the United States. He called me up and he said, we have to meet. It's very important. I met with him at Stern College. The Stern College is the women's division of Yeshiva University. We just wanted a place to meet. And so I met with him at Stern College. We went to a room and we sat down and he pulled out lots of papers. He had all types of plans and everything else that he gave me. He made copies and had all types of plans of what I'm supposed to do and why I'm supposed to do this. Press conference and demonstrations and office and all types of plans he had laid out for me. And we discussed it. We spent a couple hours there discussing it. And he said, you're going to take over. I'm going to announce that you're taking over and you're going to take over and this is what you're going to do. What happened was the rabbi's supporters, Rabbi Kahana's supporters, vetoed his plan. They said, what? You're going to let Chaim ben Pesach take over JDL? Chaim ben Pesach is crazy. Chaim ben Pesach is going to go bombing. He's crazy. He's going to get us all into trouble. We're all going to wind up in jail if Chaim ben Pesach takes over JDL. Now, Rabbi Kahana knew that I was going to go out and bomb. He knew that part was true. Even though we couldn't say it openly because they would have arrested me immediately. But he knew that I was going to do. He knew that. Yes, he knew I was going to do that. And he wanted me to do that. But he also knew that I would never get other people in the movement in trouble. Even when I did go out and bomb, and in the end I did dozens of bombings. Even when I went out and did do bombings. All the people who supported our movement, none of them ever got in any trouble at all. Not one person who contributed to our movement, who went to our demonstrations, who was part of our chapters, even the leaders of our chapters, and the people on our executive board, the JDL, we had a JDL executive board, none of them ever got into any legal trouble. The only people who had legal problems and who eventually went to prison were the two or three of us that were directly involved in the bombings, in these activities. We were the only ones that had any legal problems. No one else ever did. And Rabbi Kahana knew that no one else was going to have any problems. But these These were petty people. They didn't like me. They didn't like what I represented. They wanted JDL to have a more establishment-type image, to be more respectable. They didn't like the way I spoke about Jesse Jackson and about the black leaders. They preferred Irv Rubin, the way Irv Rubin would speak. Irv Rubin would actually praise Jesse Jackson and praise black leaders. And went around, Jesse Jackson, Irv Rubin was friends with actors and actresses in Hollywood, and, you know, they liked that. They didn't like the fact, now these were Rabbi Kahana's followers, so they didn't like the fact that Irv Rubin also condemned Rabbi Kahana and was against, you know, so they didn't support Irv Rubin either, because he was against Rabbi Kahana, but they would have preferred that type of leadership, making JDL into like the AD, they wanted the JDL to be the ADL, God forbid, but that's what they wanted. They wanted a JDL that acts like the ADL. And they knew with Chaim ben Pesach, you're never going to have that. That they understood. So anyway, they vetoed this plan and I was not able to take over JDL. The rabbi called me up. He said, I couldn't convince him. He said, I argued with them for 3 hours at our meeting. We had an executive board meeting. I argued with them for 3 hours and I could not convince, most of them, I could not convince to let you take over. So the plan was delayed. I had to actually form a different group other than JDL called Jewish Direct Action, JDA, Jewish Direct Action. And we bombed the Soviet diplomatic complex in Riverdale. We blew up two of their cars there, and we started the campaign with that. And it was on the front pages of every newspaper. It was a huge story. Rabbi Kahana loved it. I mean, it was really great. It started, the Soviets, they were shocked because they saw, oh, this is starting again? What the hell is this? So I put together a new organization called Jewish Direct Action, and we did it with Jewish Direct Action. We met in 83, and in February of 1984, we did our first bombing. And we held a press conference, and we did various other things, which you can't do today. You couldn't do that. Today, if you held a press conference applauding something, and you were bombing, and you were also running an open organization, they throw you in jail right away today. Because post 9/11, there are new laws, and you can't do what we were able to do then. You have to remember, this is pre-9/11. In any event, eventually I did take over JDL, of course, about a year later. Rabbi Kahana pushed and pushed, and eventually, you know, I did take over. Some of the rabbi's followers walked out and left because of that. They refused to be involved with the organization because of that. So it just shows, you know, it just shows what you have to go through. And some of it was just so petty. It was based on such pettiness. You know, some people just, you know, they don't like you for some reason. For some reason, they didn't like me. Okay, they don't like me. Fine, don't like me. But you know that I'm going to get the job done for Soviet Jews. You know that I'm the type of person that's going to go out and do what has to be done for Soviet Jews. Isn't that more important than whether or not you like me personally? You don't have to like me personally, but if it helps free our brothers and sisters in the Soviet Union. And I don't know why they didn't like me. I never did anything to these people. I never did anything bad to any of these people. So why they didn't like me, I don't know. But they didn't. They wanted a more establishment type JDL. And you know, these are people who supported Rabbi Kahana. So I don't know why they thought I was so radical. Because Rabbi Kahana used to say the same things that I used to say. Anyway, whatever. Maybe because he was in Israel all these years and they forgot about what it was like when he was living in New York. I mean, when he was in Israel all these years, he would only come back here and just make speeches. So they figured he just gives speeches, so he's okay. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but it held up and undermined our campaign to free Soviet Jews, the pettiness. It just held up and undermined our campaign. And that really hurt Rabbi Kahana. He was really disturbed by it. He said, I don't understand this sinat chinam, this needless hatred. I don't understand the pettiness. I don't understand the personality conflicts. You know, he called me up, he apologized to me, and he said, I don't know why this is happening like this. It's really, you know, it's really pathetic, he said. But anyway, in the end, Baruch Hashem, thank God, we still got the job done in the end, and we still were able to conduct our campaign to free Soviet Jews, but we had all types of roadblocks all the way, unnecessary roadblocks, and that's a shame. That's a shame, and that really bothered Rabbi Kahana, because Rabbi Kahana dreamed of a world where the Jewish people would be a light unto the nations and a holy nation, nation of priests that would rise above all of this and fight for justice and truth and righteousness. That's the world that he dreamed of. Thank you, Kahana Loyalist. And now we go to the great EB22, who writes, and I quote, "At this point in time, around 9 months before the midterm elections in the U.S., what are your expectations for the overall House and Senate races?" Unquote. My expectation is that the Republicans are going to make gains in both the House and the Senate. The Republicans already, of course, have a majority in the House. I think they're going to increase their majority, even though I know that there are some who say that that's not going to happen. They're probably going to lose a few seats because of demographic reasons and retirements and other, even though you have retirements in both parties. Nevertheless, the Democrats and the media, some people in the media have been predicting that the House majority is going to actually narrow. I don't think so. I think that they're going to make some gains in the House. I might be wrong, but that's my impression. And in the Senate, I think they're going to make gains. Will they actually take over the Senate? Will they win a majority in the Senate? That I don't know. But I do think that they're going to pick up some Senate seats. I think they're going to make gains. Right now, it's 55-45 in the Senate, 55 Democrats to 45 Republicans. I think that the number of Republican seats will increase. How much? I don't know. But I do think that's going to happen. Thank you, EB22. And we go now to our great friend Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, "Comment on the Haredi protests. How should they be dealt with? To throw those who don't show up in jail, cut off their funding?" Unquote. Okay. Tag Mechir is referring here to the protests of the Haredim, the religious Jews that don't want to serve in the Israeli army because they want to be in the yeshiva world, and they say that the Israeli army causes assimilation and is not... There are other problems in serving in the Israeli army. They don't want to serve in the Israeli army. They say they want to study in yeshivot. I do not believe that the plan to force them into the Israeli army is a good plan. I do not support that. So I don't want to throw them in jail, and I don't think that we should cut off their funding to threaten them that they have to go into the Israeli army. If the Israeli army was really the Jewish army that we want, fighting for the Jewish people, that would be a different story. Then maybe I would want a tougher stand. But when we have an Israeli army whose main purpose is to throw Jews out of their homes in Judea and Samaria and harass the good Jews of Judea and Samaria and brainwash Jewish soldiers into not acting against our enemies and tie the hands of Jewish soldiers and let Jewish soldiers be murdered, because they're so worried about doing... I mean, we've shown you film where Arab terrorists are throwing big rocks at Jewish soldiers and the Jewish soldiers have to stand there and take it. I mean, this is an obscenity. I do not believe anyone should be forced into an army that acts like that. An army that acts like that, I don't think anybody should be forced into. I'm ashamed of the Israeli army, not proud of it. And so I do not favor punishing them for not going into the Israeli army. When we have an army that fights for the Jewish people once again, that would be a different story. And we did once have an army like that. I think during the Six-Day War, and I think during other periods, we had an army that was doing an important job for the Jewish people in the past. I really do. And I think that it was worthwhile for people to join the army, even though we had problems then too. But I still think it was worthwhile because we have to, of course, have a military force to defend Israel and defend the Jewish people. But now that we have an army that is so corrupted and so controlled by the extreme left and so politically correct and so destructive for the Jewish settlement enterprise and for so many other things that we care about, I would not force anybody to have to join that type of army. And now Tag Mechir writes, and I quote, "Perush HaMakabi Shiur." Okay, Shiur means a lesson, and Perush HaMakabi, of course, is the great book of Moreinu VeRabbeinu HaRav Meir Kahana, our leader and our teacher, Rabbi Meir Kahana. In Perush HaMakabi, Rabbi Kahana writes about the terrible punishment of Israel when they were expelled from their homeland because they sinned against Hashem. They refused to do what Hashem commanded them to do, and so they're expelled from their homeland. And Rabbi Kahana writes about what a horrific punishment this was. How only a small remnant would survive the 2,000 years of assimilation and persecution. What a price the Jewish people would pay for their immoral behavior, for their anti-Torah behavior. What a terrible price. The rabbi goes through the verses in the Torah and in Nevi'im, also in the prophets, the Nevi'im, which tell us how Israel was supposed to be a huge, how do you say, kerem, like a huge vineyard, a beautiful, huge vineyard, wide expanses and growing and flourishing. And instead, the Jews were like a little portion of the vineyard, cut off, almost desolate, because they were being punished for their bad behavior. How only a remnant would even make it to the final redemption because of this terrible behavior. And the rabbi, of course, by doing this, asks us, is it worth it defying God? Can there be any intelligent or sensible or logical benefit from defying God, from defying what he commands us to do? Isn't it obvious that when God commands us to do something, it's for our own good and that it will in the end be good? Isn't that obvious? That's the question the rabbi poses so eloquently in Perush HaMakabi. Thank you, Tag Mechir. And we now go to the great Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, do you believe it is possible that Iran has already acquired nuclear weapons and is keeping quiet about it, unquote? No, I don't think so. I think they're very close, but I don't think that they've acquired the nuclear weapons yet. No. Is it possible that they'll achieve a nuclear weapons capacity and be only a few weeks away from actually building a nuclear bomb, but not actually build a bomb, but be in a situation where they could assemble it in only a few weeks, and stay in that situation so they can get all the sanctions lifted, and meanwhile actually technically still be a nuclear power? Is it possible we'll have that type of scenario? Yes. God forbid. That's a terrible scenario. That's a nightmare. But I don't think we're there yet. Israel still can destroy Iran's nuclear bomb-making program if we had a prime minister who was a real leader for a change. It still could happen. Thank you, Maimonides. And by the way, I don't think Netanyahu is planning to do that, unfortunately, but militarily, Israel, I believe, is capable of doing it. And now we go to our great friend Maim Koran, who writes, and I quote, isn't it interesting that even Al-Qaeda considers the, quote, Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, unquote, to be extremist, but Obama doesn't? Are Al-Qaeda the new moderates? Unquote. Great point, Maim Koran. Well, you know, first of all of these terms, moderate and all these, are this is absurd. Muslims will always adopt whatever tactics they have to adopt to achieve world conquest, to achieve world jihad. Al-Qaeda, if you recall, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, the Al-Qaeda fighters, they were actually allies of the United States in the war in Afghanistan against the Soviets. That's how it started. The United States was arming and training these Muslim terrorists to fight against the Soviets in Afghanistan, and thinking that they have new allies in the Muslim world. They don't understand that when you shake hands with a Muslim, you have to count your fingers, that it's only a matter of time before the Muslims are going to stab their ally in the back. They always do. They always stab each other in the back. So now Al-Qaeda is now the Al-Qaeda in Yemen and in other parts of the, you know, Yemen and Afghanistan and other parts of the Muslim world. They're feuding with the Al-Qaeda elements in Iraq and Syria. Now, this is just par for the course. This is just what they do. There are no moderates. They all agree with world conquest, and they all want to be the conquering leaders, and so they all stab each other in the back. Nothing new. Nothing new, but there are no real allies there. And the fact that Obama supports and gives money to and arms and trains Iraq and Syria and the Syrian so-called rebels who are controlled by al-Qaeda and supports the government of Iraq. And I mean, this is just insanity. Unbelievable. It's just unbelievable that we have a president who is such a Muslim. I mean, he is just a Muslim, and he supports Muslim terrorism. Thank you, Main Quran. And now we go to, let me just check something quickly. Yes, okay, good. We go to the great Ephraim ben Noach, who writes, could you talk a little about this week's Torah and Haftarah portion? Thanks, Chaim, unquote. Okay, great, Ephraim. I'm just looking here for a second. I'm opening up my... Here we go. Okay. This week's parasha is Parashat Tetzaveh. I'm just opening up my Torah, by the way, for those of you wondering what I'm opening. This is Parashat Tetzaveh. This parasha speaks mainly about the clothes that the priests wear in the tabernacle. You know, the Jews in the Sinai had to build a holy tabernacle, which was like training for the building of the Holy Temple in Jerusalem eventually. While they were wandering in the Sinai for 40 years, they built the Holy Tabernacle, HaMishkan. It's called the tabernacle in Hebrew is HaMishkan. And that was training for Beit HaMikdash. Beit HaMikdash is the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. And so the Kohanim, the priests, had to have special clothes. The high priest had 8 pieces of clothing. And the simple priest had 4 pieces of clothing. So the high priest had 4 extra pieces of clothing in addition to the 4 pieces that a simple priest had. Now, what's the purpose of clothes in general? Putting this aside for a moment, what is the purpose of, why do we wear clothes? First of all, as long as we're sinful, we need clothes. In Gan Eden, in the Garden of Eden, Adam v'Chava, Adam and Eve, didn't need any clothes. They didn't have any clothes. Because in the Garden of Eden, there was no sin. They were not living in sin yet. So they didn't need clothes. But of course, once they ate from the tree, and sin was brought into the world by their behavior, then they realized they were naked and they were ashamed and they had to wear clothes. They weren't innocent anymore. Now, if today we see a naked person, if we see some naked person walking down the street today, we would immediately think primarily about the person's body parts. We wouldn't think about the person's inner soul. We would see the person's body parts, and the person's body parts would be the first thing that would come to mind, the first thing that would influence what we think of this person. So we have to cover those body parts, and we have to have clothes so that all of our thoughts are not on just the physical aspects of a person, that they're also about the personality and the character of somebody. Because our body is also, you know, our body is also a form of clothing. Our body is a form of clothing that covers our soul. You can have a very attractive person who is evil, and you can have a very unattractive person who is righteous. The body covers the soul. What somebody looks like does not necessarily tell you what that person's character is about, what that person's personality is about. The priests need special clothing to help atone for the sins of all of Israel when the priests appear before Hashem, before God. They need to cover. They need that cover. Because Israel does sin. And for them to appear before God and get close to God, they have to wear this special clothing that God commanded them to wear. Of course, it's not enough. Even if they wear this special clothing, if they're going to be evil, that's not going to help them. It's not going to cover anything. But if they do what is right and they wear this clothing and they follow what the Torah says, they follow all of the rituals and all of the other things that that God says you should follow for purity of soul. If they do all of that, then they can indeed get close to God and bring atonement for the sins of Israel. The special clothing of the priests also serves as a reminder to all of Israel and to the whole world how we have to clothe ourselves in righteousness in order to pass God's judgment. Because we have a body that serves as a form of clothing over our soul. And then we put clothes over our body. But the fact is, we have to clothe ourselves in righteousness. We have to clothe ourselves in righteous deeds and in morals and in good thoughts and in loving our fellow human beings and fighting for what's right and fighting for justice and truth. We have to clothe ourselves with those values and with that life and with fulfilling those commandments. We have to clothe ourselves with that if we're going to pass God's judgment. And so clothing has very important symbolic value. It reminds us of what we have to do in our lives, of what we're supposed to represent in our lives. Now, and so this particular parasha, this particular Torah portion, Tetzaveh, which is called Tetzaveh, is about the clothing of the priests in the tabernacle and how important clothing can be in our lives and how important it is that we clothe ourselves in righteousness and in truth. The Haftarah that accompanies this parasha is from, the Haftarah is from Yechezkel HaNavi, Ezekiel the prophet, Perek Mem Gimel, which is chapter 43. And it speaks about the sacrifices in the temple which bring people closer to God. You know, the purpose of the sacrifices is to bring people closer to God. The temple was like an embassy, like heaven's embassy in this world, where God had a special presence in this world, where people would go into that temple and have prophetic experiences and spiritual experiences that would uplift them. People think, they're going to sacrifice animals and all this other stuff. Oh, what type of thing is this? No, the temple gave people a spiritual uplifting and even a prophetic experience in terms of being before God that we who have not experienced that cannot understand. People who went to that temple, their lives were changed when they went into the holy temple. If they had the right experience and went in with the proper attitude, their lives were changed, were altered in a very positive way. And so the Haftarah speaks about the sacrifices and about the things that are done at the temple to cleanse us and to bring us closer to God. And that, of course, is relevant because it is connected to the parasha this week as well about the clothing of the priests. Thank you, Ephraim. And I want to thank everybody for another program that I very much enjoyed doing. Until next week, Shalom.